Hello and welcome to the IEA podcast. This conversation between Nick Timothy, former Joint Chief of Staff to Prime Minister Theresa May and author of Remaking One Nation, The Future of Conservatism, and IEA Research Director Saeed Kamal was recorded as a live event for members of the IEA Book Club. You can find the original video on the IEA's YouTube channel, IEA London, where you can also subscribe and never miss a future episode. For more information about the IEA Book Club and all the IEA's other work, you can visit our website iea.org.uk or subscribe to our newsletters.
So what I'm trying to do with the book is to trace the problems we have today back to the original ideas behind the policies that got us here in the first place. In particular, I'm trying to explore some of the flaws in philosophical liberalism and the ways in which liberalism is mutated into what I call ultra-extreme forms on the left, right, and centre of politics. And my argument is that conservatism, that is small c conservatism, can help the big C conservative party to overcome ideology and become a little bit more communitarian and make us one nation once again. And I argue that we have to start looking at liberalism, the ideology that has really made our world in Britain and the West, with a more sceptical eye. Because many aspects of life that we have been told were unavoidable and universal, inevitable and irreversible, are really no such thing at all. Really, they are the product of ideology. Now, that ideology obviously isn't as extreme as those it's easy for politicians and commentators to reject, like communism and fascism, but it is an ideology all the same, and it's ideological liberalism. And like all ideologies, as its contradictions mount, ultra-liberalism is growing illiberal and intolerant towards dissenters and retreating into delusion and denial. So the book is an attempt to explain how things have got this far and what conservatives can do about it. So I argue that we need to counter ultra-liberalism and develop a new conservative agenda that respects personal freedom, yes, but also demands greater solidarity, that reforms capitalism as we have it today and rebuilds community and rejects some of the more selfish elements of behaviour across society and embrace more our obligations towards other people. But the book is also a warning that conservatives have to be careful to defend the essential liberalism that helps us to have a pluralistic society and a democratic way of life. So essential liberalism, I say, is what makes liberal democracy function. It requires not only elections to determine who governs us, but checks and balances to protect minorities from the tyranny of the majority. It demands good behavioural norms, including a willingness to accept the outcome of election results, which obviously lots of people did not after the 2016 referendum. And it requires support for free markets. Essential liberalism doesn't seek to turn every aspect of life into a market, but it knows that economic freedom is closely related to personal freedom and also other values, including dignity and justice and security and recognition from our fellow citizens. And the power of essential liberalism, I think, is that it doesn't pretend to provide a general theory of rights or justice or an ideological framework that can lead towards the harmonization of human interests and values or even a single philosophical truth. It respects political diversity and allows for all sorts of different policy choices from criminal justice to the tax system. And it understands that human values and interests are often in conflict. So my right to privacy might undermine your right to security. A transsexual's right to be recognized as a woman might undermine the safety of women born as women. We need institutions, laws, and a limited number of legal rights to handle those conflicts. We need customs and traditions to maintain our shared identities and build up trust. Maintaining the fragile balance between conflicting values and interests is a difficult and delicate job. And that's why, as liberalism gets more ideological, it can grow dangerous. I don't claim that there is a single ultra-liberal agenda. People like Tony Blair and George Osborne stand for a kind of elite liberalism. Their beliefs are shared by most members of the governing classes, but not the wider public. And so you have, despite public opposition and changes in ministers and parties in government, Britain continuing with policies like mass immigration, multiculturalism, a lightly regulated labour market, limited support for the family, and so on. But then we also have something I call the ultra-liberal ratchet, which is beliefs that are not shared across the party divide, but which still keep propelling liberalism forward. So on the right, you have market reformers thinking mainly of the economy, but on the left, you have left liberals who are pursuing an agenda of cultural liberalism and militant identity politics. And what often happens is, one side might sometimes reverse some changes made by the other, but in the end, most of them remain, and market reformers and left liberals end up reinforcing one another by leaving us with a sense of economic dislocation and social atomization in a state that actually perversely ends up growing as it tries to pick up the pieces. And the trouble with all these forms of ultra-liberalism is that if you go back to the philosophical concepts it's based on, they're based on a conception of humanity that isn't really real. If you go back to the original liberal thinkers, liberal thought was built on the premise that there are not only universal values, but natural and universal rights. And they made this argument by imagining the state of nature with, life with no kind of government at all. And they argued that so miserable that existence would be, that humans would come together to form a social contract setting out the government's powers and the rights of citizens. And this sort of hardwired several features into liberalism from the beginning. It means that liberalism assumes that we as citizens are autonomous and rational individuals. Our consent to liberal government is assumed, and rights are natural and universal. And this explains, I think, why many liberals, not all liberals, but many liberals, fall into the trap of believing that the historical, cultural, and institutional context of government is irrelevant. It behaves as though institutions and traditions are that impose obligations on us can just be cast away. All that matters, as far as government is concerned, is the freedom of the individual and the preservation of their property. And so liberal democracy can just be dropped into a rack and made to work like it does in Britain. At home, we can be given a growing number of legal rights without any corresponding responsibilities. And our duties to others are treated like they're just kind of unfair hindrances. And those liberal thinkers often ignore our kind of relational nature, our dependence on others, and our reliance on the institutions and norms of community life. Lots of them take community and nation for granted and have pretty much little to say, I think, about the obligations as well as the rights of citizenship. The nation state can therefore hand over its powers to remote and unaccountable supranational institutions. Transnational citizenship rights can be bestowed upon foreign nationals. Public services should be freely available to people who have never contributed to them. And then with later liberal thinkers, you then get other flawed ideas. So John Stuart Mill, for example, devised the harm principle, in which the liberty of the individual should be restricted only if his actions risk damaging the interests of others. And even then, there would be no encroachment on liberty to ensure conformity with the moral beliefs of the community, to prevent people harming themselves, or if the restriction was disproportionate. The problem with the harm principle is that it fails to acknowledge that all of our actions and inactions to some degree affect all of us and people around us. And precisely because human values and interests conflict with one another, we'll never really agree about what clearly constitutes harm. And yet you can sort of see the harm principle in the way policymakers behave now, when we have attitudes towards things like the use of hard drugs as though there are no consequences for anybody but the individual user, or a reluctance to force fathers to meet their obligations to their families, or to refuse to take action against serial tax dodging individuals and businesses. And Mill and some other liberal thinkers sometimes made the case for pluralism and tolerance on the basis that they make trial and error possible. And that trial and error leads us to truth and an increasingly perfect society. So there's a kind of teleological fallacy that's built into liberalism, this assumption that your own beliefs stand for progress. And that is what can lead liberalism towards illiberalism. It's intolerance of supposedly backward opinions, norms, and institutions can quickly become intolerance of those who remain loyal to sort of older or traditional ways of life. And I think this is a particular problem. This illiberalism is a particular problem for the ultra-liberal left. And in the book, I argue that left liberals are influenced by postmodernists like Michel Foucault and some of the American thinkers behind the rise of identity politics, because they've accepted some of the arguments promoted by people like Foucault that that you know, discourse itself is oppressive, that people are not necessarily in charge of their own destinies, that their social reality is imposed on them through language and customs and institutions. And even the victims of the powerful participate in their own oppression through their own language, stories, and assumed social roles. And because oppressive discourses work to favour those at the top of what are exploitative hierarchies, left liberals don't want to just remove the hierarchy, but penalise the people who subjugate others. So that means the sort of the classical liberal assumption that equal political rights are what we should want are not enough, because historically power lay with white men, for example. Today, whiteness and masculinity are things that can be attacked because we don't understand how our social roles are constructed. We don't understand the meaning of even our own words as we say them or write them. And in fact, the people who hear us, particularly if they're members of marginalised groups, are said to understand better than we do the true meaning of what we say. And because discourse is itself a form of violence, free speech becomes no longer sacrosanct, and it's legitimate to meet violent language with sometimes violent direct action. And then on the right, sometimes support for the free market can sometimes turn into something more extreme that blinds those believers from some lived economic reality. So struggling communities shorn of their social capital, lacking infrastructure, and with few opportunities for their young people are quite often ignored with the assumption that the invisible hand of the market is likely to come to the rescue. And instead, the sort of the policy energy of these believers is devoted to things like trying to deregulate the labour market or marketising public goods. And obviously, you know, people at the IEA will be familiar with the works of Hayek, who's a big influence in this strand of thinking. And he argued that, you know, no political system, not even a democratic one, nor even a very small and local one, can accurately reflect collective choice in the way a market does. Now that is often true, but markets or systems of public services are quite often constructed or devised with different values in mind than simply the freedom of the individual users. But for his followers, his supporters, the logic then takes you into the place that, say, for example, the NHS cannot be the right way of delivering healthcare because consumer choices and real pricing don't drive decision making. And the same goes for other public services, from public transport to schooling. And I think one of the weaknesses in the argument we have about the NHS sometimes is that people on the right sometimes, I think, forget or appear to reject the idea that that in Britain, our health system was created with principles like equality and solidarity in mind, rather than the freedom of the individual user to seek their own superior care. So basically, in the book, I argue that we need a break with ultra-liberalism in all of its forms. And I do think there are signs that under Boris, The Conservatives are shifting away from the sort of purities of economic and cultural liberalism. Time will obviously tell if that's what happens. Of course, I'm arguing from a position where I hope it will, because as I say in the book, there is more to life than markets, more to conservatism than the individual, and more to the future than the decline or destruction of cultures and nations.
Thanks very much for listening. You can subscribe to all of our The IEA podcasts on Podbean, Apple or Spotify, and you can check out all of the IEA's new videos on our YouTube channel, which you can also subscribe to. To make sure you never miss an episode, visit the IEA website, iea.org.uk, and subscribe to IEA Daily to get the latest news, views and reports from all of our staff straight to your inbox.